One of the most memorable conversations we had on this show in 2015 was with Vin Baker. We had it towards the end of the year. Vin's a four-time NBA All-Star and an Olympic gold medal winner, had a very distinguished pro basketball career, and then went through a lot. His problems with alcohol and money management caused him to crash out of the sky and down for a very hard landing. So I began our conversation with Vin sitting in the studio asking him, you know, how did he think of himself? Does he think of himself as a four-time NBA All-Star, or does he think of himself in a different way?
I definitely think four-time All-Star and Olympian. Those are things that you can never take away regardless of what we go through in life. Those are accomplishments that were spectacular and amazing, and I was blessed and fortunate to be a part of it. So I never want to discount that, no matter what I've been through. They've been a part of me. It's been a part of my growth to be an All-Star, be an Olympian, and also other things that have happened in my life. I'm a minister. I'm a father. All those things have played important roles into my character and who I am now.
Well, I want to talk about all of those different things, but maybe we should just sort of begin with your story. I mean, very quickly, you grew up in Old Saybrook, right?
I did. I grew up in Old Saybrook. Old Saybrook, actually went to elementary school there, and all of my schooling came there. I enjoyed being in Old Saybrook. I actually live there now. It's a great town. I love the people there. My mom and dad have been there since the 60s, so we are blue blood Old Saybrook Rams, and, you know, just an awesome childhood. I grew up middle class and worked hard. My father was a minister. My mother worked from 4 to 1 at Cheeseboro Pond. So just grew up in a working class house and a spiritual house.
At what point was it clear that you were going to be very tall and very athletic?
It actually didn't come until I was about my senior year in high school. I was a late bloomer as far as even my height came late. I was 6'2 as a freshman and then 6'7 as a senior and then 6'10 grew to be 6'10 from my senior year of high school to my freshman year at the University of Hartford. So my athletic prowess didn't really come until I was 18, 19 years old, when I kind of grew into my body and took off from there.
So for that reason, I mean, a lot of the big basketball programs, they kind of didn't know who you were, didn't necessarily pursue you as you were heading into college.
No, a lot of colleges didn't know. I think that, ironically, two of the other teams, University of Rhode Island, and believe it or not, Coach Calhoun kind of knew who I was because I'd gone to his basketball camp my junior year and my senior year. And I can remember Coach Calhoun coming over and sitting at one of my games with a trench coat on and a hat. So he kind of knew at the time who I was, but obviously wasn't prepared and ready for that level of basketball just yet.
So you went to University of Hartford, and I mean, it's certainly no exaggeration to say that you're the best player who has ever played for the University of Hartford, although they've had other really good basketball players. Your jersey, I think, is hanging up in the field house now. And so, but I would imagine also University of Hartford was probably a pretty good bubble to realize that you were a standout basketball player. You weren't necessarily subjected to the crushing pressures that you would be at Kansas or someplace like that.
Absolutely. It was a great place for me to develop as a kid, especially coming from Old Saybrook, such a small town. It was the perfect fit for me. If I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't have chose anything different. The university, the school, the atmosphere there, the coaching staff, everything was perfect. Coach Phelan was Jack Phelan and Paul Brazo were my two coaches there, but Coach Phelan in particular really helped me and molded me into be really a really tough kid on the basketball court, and along with my talent, got me to the place I needed to be in 1993.
You know, I would imagine that might have been something that you had to work a little harder on than some people. I don't expect you to remember this, but I met you while you were at University of Hartford. And even talking to you now over a brief period of time, you seem like a very nice person, that by and large, you know, you're more gentle than you are mean. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got to discover some kind of toughness in yourself. If you're going to compete, particularly at the NBA level, you know, it's him or you in a lot of situations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you have to learn that?
No, I that really came from my mom and my dad. My mom and dad were very tough. I always tell everyone I love my mom more than life, and she's the toughest person I know. She was very tough on me growing up and, you know, very competitive, but in a loving way. Mm-hmm. So, and then my dad is 6'7". He's a minister, very believes in what he believes in and a tough man in his own right. So it really came from my mom and my dad. So I think the whole thing of being from Old Saber kind of glossed over who I am at the core as far as my competitive nature and how hard. So it really wasn't something I had to adapt or change. It's just that my coaching staff, in particular Coach Phelan, really brought it out of me. And once he got it out of me, it stayed.
Although I think also the jump that you made from there was a bigger jump than a lot of people make, right? Mm-hmm. If you'd gone from Kentucky to the Milwaukee Bucks, that would have been one thing. Going from University of Hartford to the Milwaukee Bucks is another thing, right? I mean, you were being introduced to a new world.
Yeah, definitely. From a basketball perspective, though, I think it's neat. And I think I can use this analogy now because we have a guy that kind of was a big fish in a small pond who's probably the best player in the entire world right now. And so my development, I wouldn't have changed it. I said this, I alluded to this earlier. I wouldn't have changed my path because going to the University of Hartford as opposed to going to Kentucky or University of Connecticut, it allowed me to grow as a player. I could take the ball off the rim and dribble the basketball up the court and without being yelled at and without being told to get on the block. Those 4 years at the University of Hartford developed me into be the most skillful or one of the more skillful basketball players at my size in the entire world. So I wouldn't have changed it for the world to go to Kentucky and be recruited over every single waking minute of the day and not being allowed to be who I could become. So I'm so grateful. And like you look at Steph Curry, he went to
Dave. He's the guy you were talking about, right?
That's who I was talking about. And there's no way he got that confidence from Davidson. Who's to say if he'd have gone to Kentucky or Duke or where his brother went or any other bigger school, he would have developed that confidence like he has now.
Were there ways in which the NBA was kind of a rude awakening, though? I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I think a lot of it's well documented for me. I think for me, the off the court, just the lifestyle itself, growing up in Old Saybrook and then ultimately going to the University of Hartford for my 4 years collegiately never prepared me for what the NBA offered personally and off the court, my private life, which I was ill prepared for and really ran into some tumultuous times based on the fact that I felt I was ill prepared to deal with fame and fortune the way it came so fast for me.
I mean, does anybody, I mean, maybe it's different now, and we'll talk about that as we go along here, but when you went up there, does anybody sort of stop and say, hey, before this gets going pretty fast, before the train starts moving really fast, here's some things you should know, either in terms of looking out after your money or the kinds of people who are approaching you or some of the pitfalls, some of the parties you'll be invited to. Is there anybody on an NBA team or within the league who kind of does that?
I mean, there's times when they come when there are situations where there may be some red flags or some fires that they may need to put out. But initially, when you first get in the league, it's literally like hitting a lottery ticket. It's imagine getting a lottery ticket and you get $1 million. Like, you're not going to hear from advisors first. You're not going to hear from people who want to have your best interest. You're going to hear from the people who want something from you or want to go into a different place to have fun, to party. So it's just like that in the NBA. It'd be neat and fun to say and appropriate to say that, you know, there's things in place when you get all this money and you get this fame and you get this fortune and people always have your best interest. That's just not the case. And there's more places for pitfalls with that kind of lifestyle than there is for people to come out shining and saying, oh, I did 15 years and nothing ever happened.
Well, you've got a whole bunch of things coming together at once, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you've got this money like you've never had money before. Mm-hmm. And your view of the world is more distorted than it's ever been. People are telling you you're great. People are screaming louder than they've ever screamed before. You're playing in front of bigger crowds than you've ever played before. And you're getting invited places that you would never have gotten invited under any other circumstances. You're hanging out with people you wouldn't have met under other circumstances. So any one of those could create a problem. Mm-hmm. The three of them stuck together, I would imagine, is a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. I mean, at some point for me, it was even being drafted the number 8th pick in 1993 from the University of Hartford and then going to a relatively small market. So I was still in this proving ground. Even though I was the 8th pick, of the draft in a lottery pick. So I had the challenge of going and still trying to prove myself in the pros. And then on some hands, I was getting recognized because now all these accolades are coming and I'm being recognized for being one of the better players in the league and in the world. But I'm still trying to convince people. And so those are all kind of crazy situations that come into play when you're trying to continue to develop and continue to try to hone your craft and become one of the best.
We're talking to Vin Baker right now. He's a former NBA All-Star, former Olympic gold medal winner, and he's writing a book right now about, in fact, his life and times and the things that he went through. So, I mean, it's going to be in the book. It's a well-documented thing. You started to have problems with alcohol. Was that the first thing? Was that the first demon to kind of grab your leg? Was it the alcohol?
Yeah, definitely. I really had no idea and concept. It's been in my family for years, with family members. And, of course, if you have it in your DNA, at some point you have a chance to be exposed to becoming an alcoholic or being addicted. And it was certainly in my personality, something that I didn't detect at the University of Hartford or earlier on in my career. But with the more success and, my first 4 years – of the NBA, I was named to the All-Star team 3 times. I had my own sneaker by Brand Jordan, the Vindicator. I had made at some point, over $100 million in my first 6 or 7 years. And I was ill-prepared to handle what this fame and fortune came with off the court. And so I handled my fame and fortune very irresponsibly. I got away from the things that got me there, my spirituality, my trust in my faith and believe in God and what he's done for me, and started believing in my own hype. And it led me down a tumultuous, dark, dark path in which I'm blessed and fortunate to be out of now and seeing some light.
One senses that you were a very serious alcoholic. Was it something, would you be sometimes drunk during a game? Did you ever play having consumed alcohol?
I drank a lot of alcohol. I think it's well documented. They didn't terminate my contract because I was a weekend warrior. I'll just say that much. The alcohol really took a toll on my life. It really took a detour in my career. And I was an absolute alcoholic. And, it just got as dark as it could possibly be. I'm blessed. Like I said, I'm blessed and fortunate today to on April 17th of next year, I'll be 5 years sober. And I couldn't be any more happier spiritually and physically to be in that place. But, yeah, it was some dark, dark times. And I became a person I didn't know, drinking every single night, being depressed, not knowing how to be a all-star basketball player, an Olympic gold medalist with all this fame and fortune and not knowing how to tell someone, hey, I think I got an issue here. Mm-hmm. And that was a scary place to be because on one hand, I had developed into be this super basketball player with this enormous amount of talent. But I also had this secret that I was also struggling with addiction to alcohol that I couldn't tell until ultimately it caught up to me with the Boston Celtics, and I think it's documented how that whole ordeal went down.
We're talking to Vin Baker right now. By the way, speaking of anniversaries, another big anniversary, I think it was yesterday, right? You turned 44?
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
So somebody must have talked to you. Somebody must have said something to you. I mean, your family, somebody must have said along the way, you're drinking a lot or we're worried or...
A lot of people, I'm sure, were concerned, Colin, but I'll be honest with you and just being totally candid about it. When you're making $14 million a year, you either buy off the people who are saying something or you shut out the people who are saying something. And most of the people who are want to say something are scared to remove themselves from the situation because that may cut them short financially. And so a lot of people didn't say anything where it was more about, and I did, of course, I had my mom and my dad, they cared. And and prayed and had faith that you know my addiction to alcohol would go away. But you know, I think what I don't want to miss in telling my story about what I went through with the Celtics, I honestly feel like I'm happy that those things happened the way they did. You know, I think it made me who I am today. It made me gave me more humility. It made me humble. It put me into a space where I had to understand that I had to depend and trust in the Lord more than I had been doing while I had all this money and had all this fame. So I'm grateful and thankful. And you know, you see athletes today, no matter if you still have it or don't have it, you know, athletes are going through things outside of basketball where they're close to losing their lives or they're losing their lives. And for me, it was a wake-up call. And I don't regret. There's certain things I regret as far as my family is concerned or my career is concerned. But the lesson that I was taught and the lesson that I learned, I wouldn't change it for the world.
How did you get sober? How was it? Meetings? Was it? How did you do it? People, there's somebody out there listening right now who's got a drinking problem, is thinking, well, if Vin Baker did that, I could do that. How did you do it?
When I had to get in my own mind that I really wanted to stop drinking. Now I know that sounds, you know, very simple to do, but when I was putting things in front of my sobriety, in other words, when I was with the Celtics. And my idea was, I got to stop drinking. I don't want to lose my contract. Mm-hmm. And for most people who have followed this story closely, you would think that $50 million or millions of dollars is enough to stop drinking. But addiction is addiction. It really doesn't matter who or what level of person it attacks. Once it's there, it's there. You could be broke, rich, wealthy, poor. When addiction is there, it's there. So I think the number one thing for me was I really wanted to stop. I wanted to change my life from where it was after losing my house, losing my restaurant, and more importantly, losing my family, my children. It was time to stop. And I felt like all the humility and all the things that I wanted to do for people and help people was going down the drain because I was, you know, totally engulfed in this selfish act of being drunk all the time. And so for me, it was, I need to stop to make a difference. And if I stop drinking, I can make a difference not only in my own life, that was the priority at the time, but I can make a difference in others' lives. And if at some point in your life, no matter if you're an alcoholic or and you succumb to addiction, at some point of your life, you want to have a purpose-driven life. And for me, it's helping people who may be struggling with alcoholism and may be struggling for addiction. But first, you got to want to do it for yourself. It can't be for any other reason, can't be for family, for relationships, for career. It has to be because I want to stop to save my own life. And that's what started it for me.
So that's step one, obviously, and I assume you poured everything down the sink that was in the house or whatever. Was that enough? Just wanting
no.
to do it? Yeah.
Well, the step for me was once I got it spiritually and knew for a fact that I wanted to stop, the second step was to go and to check into a rehabilitation center. Mm-hmm. And I went to a center here in Connecticut, and I only went there for a week. Now, I'd been to facilities for months and came out and relapsed. But this last time, I had made it up in my mind and my spirit. Now, if I can just go get the physical part done, which was to lay in the bed and be checked on every hour to make sure that I wouldn't suffer from a seizure or alcohol withdrawals. And once I got that part down physically, and a week later they told me I was able to walk out, and I never looked back. I said, I'm not going back to depending on alcohol, but I had to get that piece done.
Mm-hmm.
But I had made up in my mind at that point that I wasn't going back to alcoholism.
Why don't we take a break here and give you a chance to have a sip of water. And we're talking to Vin Baker right now, the great basketball player. He's got many other things to talk about. He's working on a book right now. We'll take that break. We'll come right back. We're back with Vin Baker, four-time NBA All-Star, Olympic gold medal winner, so many other things. So, you know, when we left off there, we're talking about you just sort of kicking alcohol. But my sense also is that religion is a big part of this story. I mean, even in the last thing you said, you used the phrase purpose-driven life. Mm-hmm. We all know that comes from Rick Warren. Mm-hmm. So your father's a Baptist minister. You're a minister now, right?
Yes,
so,
I am.
So what role did that play? In other words, obviously you got out of 1 week of rehab isn't going to fix you. You need some other things are going to fix you.
When I after the 1 week of rehab, I went straight to the church. I knew that as much as addiction and alcoholism is a disease of the body and of the mind, I think the majority of it, it's a disease of the spirit. Mm-hmm. and not being sound and being in a place where you can combat it spiritually. I mean, there's a lot of things set up from AA to, you know, obviously the facilities to go and rehab in. But for me, growing up in the church, I had to go back to my roots. I had to go back to trusting and believing in what I knew. That was, for me, not only just the sanctuary of the church, but that was the sanctuary of my family, my mother, my father, my kids, my wife. Going back to places where I knew I had some safety nets to really work on my spirituality. So I was able to go to Union Theological Seminary and work on my master's there, which I'm 12 credits away from receiving my master's in divinity. I had an opportunity to really, I went to the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, one of the more prestigious Baptist churches in all of the country and world. And I was able to be mentored and sit for 2.5 years under Dr. Calvin Butts III. And I was the youth minister there. So I really had an opportunity to, as I was working on staying sober, mm-hmm. I was in almost this bulletproof setting where one of the things we talk about when you're trying to change your addictive habits and, of course, change from being an alcoholic is changing people, places, and things. Mm-hmm. So going from where I was to being with Dr. Calvin Butts and being the youth minister at the Abyssinian Baptist Church and attending Union Seminary, being on campus was drastic, a drastic change for me spiritually and certainly where I was in life. And so that helped me tremendously to get a focus. It's one thing for the ministry, for me, it was, I want to tell my testimony because I think it's powerful. I think it can help to change lives. But I also have to be theologically sound and be in place where I'm just not all over the place. I have to have what's the reasons and what was the journey. And I think Union and Abyssinian and, of course, where I'm at, Full Gospel, where my father's the pastor, those three places helped me totally to get centered spiritually so I can tell a message about redemption spiritually.
It is, you know, it's interesting. Regular listeners to this show will be incredibly bored because I bring this up all the time. But, you know, the words that are said in America by more people in any given year, in any given week, are the Lord's Prayer, right? There's probably mm-hmm. nothing that's repeated mm-hmm. as many times by as many people mm-hmm. as the Lord's Prayer. And is that notion of forgive us our trespasses? Mm-hmm. But it seems as though trespass, of course, means a lot of different things. And it seems as though so much of that is being able to have an environment where you can talk about what you
yes.
did.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's it right there. And as you were, I thought I knew where you were going mm-hmm. on that. And that's one of the things when I first went back to my church and when I was able to minister down at Abyssinian is that one of the neat things that I knew is the church was probably the one place at that particular time 4 years ago that would listen to my story without being judgmental. Oh, he lost $100 million. Oh, he lost this, he lost that. Well, I knew that if I wanted any kind of redemptive power and any kind of redemptive support, the first place for me to go back, which I was accustomed to and knew about, was going back to church and going back and being able to express and talk about and talk my way through while talking about my testimony, not being judged, but strengthening me by strengthening other people, saying, I've been through this, you can get through this. And it's well done. If you Google what I've been through and you see me standing here, It's funny because when I was at Abyssinian and Dr. Butts talked to me about, you know, kind of curtailing some of the alcohol talk and some of my sermons, and I just was pouring out, you know, my testimony. And for me, it was saying that I'm in a different place as a minister, because if I stand up and say the Lord and God and faith and believe and hope, if they go home and Google me and I've never mentioned this, then I'm not going to come off as being authentic. So it was a chance for me to not only tell the story, but also to tell how I came through this journey of being an NBA player all the way to being a Baptist youth minister.
It must be hard also, though, to share some of these things. I mean, you arrived here with a beautiful little daughter in tow. She's over in our green room right now. You know, on the one hand, I mean, you're about to write the book. You're going to have to lay some of this stuff down. You may be laying it out in a way, as you say, that's your side of the story. That's the way that you understand what happened, as opposed to having that story get told about you. But even so, I mean, to go there, it's going to be hard, right? It must always be hard to have the people who love, particularly your kids, hear stories even from you about what happened.
It's true. And I will say this, though. I've been so blessed and fortunate that my children have still showed me unconditional love and unconditional respect, and not really have experienced a lot of it. And if they have Googled it and if their friends have said something about it, it really doesn't have a huge play or huge role in our family. What my kids do see is a father who works hard and who takes it to the max every day to support them financially and support them as any other father would. So there are moments that we have these conversations about my past and some of the things that they may have heard. But fortunately for me, because of the space I'm in spiritually and now being going into my fifth year of sobriety, they're all teaching points. They're all points where my kids can grow from. And I have some amazing kids who I kind of look at my situation and they say, Dad, I'll take the MBA. I'll take the University of Hartford. And I kind of know where not to go here. So I'm very not that this won't happen, but we certainly are in a place of learning and growing spiritually where we can kind of prevent it from at this point.
This is probably one of your least favorite things to think about. But I think one of the things, when people hear your story, for people who just are living kind of average lives, they think, how do you go through $100 or $115 million? I mean, most people can't figure out how to do that, right? I'm sure you get that. It's like, I wouldn't even know how to go through $115 million.
Yeah, it's hard to fathom. It's much more in perspective now because I've changed my life. But here's how to think about it if you're looking at it from that point. If you make $50,000 to $100,000 and that is your lifestyle, and if you just thrust $50 million cash on someone, you'd be like, I'd never spend this. That's because you've been living from 30 to 70. And so when it's all relative. If you have $1 million, you'll assume that you can spend $500,000 of it, and then you'll assume that you can have an entourage, and you'll assume you can buy this house and that house, and you spend it. And add to that an addiction to alcohol, it's a recipe for going broke. It's not mystical. It's I'm not the inventor of the wheel of someone who's been given a lot of money and a lot of fame and fortune and have run into financial issues just not being responsible. Those people who make 50 to 60, 70,000 bucks a year, they know every dime and they're very meticulous about how they spend. They kind of know it's the world they live in. You don't walk on a car lot with Lamborghinis if you make 50 or 60,000. You just kind of know it. But when you have a $13 million a year contract, you get really stupid and buy things that aren't necessary and you party and you hang out with people and you give money out. And so if you start adding it up and you get your contract gets terminated, there's a way it happens. Now, it might not make sense and people might not be happy about it and people might say you've fooled, but at some point it happens based on the lifestyles and the choices that we make. And again, I'm not the first athlete who's been in that situation. But I want to be the first athlete to say that you can grow and learn, and you can bounce back, and you can have a productive life. And everything doesn't depend on – I've learned that everything doesn't boil down to being wealthy and having the biggest houses and having the biggest cars. It boils down to what type of person you are and what kind of effect do you want to have on your kids and just society in general. I don't think I was the best person that I could possibly be when I was making $13 million a year. I like myself now as a person than I did then. I would love to have that money with this attitude, but I don't know if they live in the same and if they could possibly live in the same person.
You know, I know that you've been brought into contact with young NBA players. I mean, it continues to happen. I think Jason Kidd had you go to the Milwaukee Bucks summer program in Vegas. Obviously, you've got some very useful things to tell people about how to post somebody up. But I would imagine you have even more useful things to say to a young player. I mean, you're talking about $13 million contracts. The contracts today are bigger than that, right?
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
What do you say to people? What do you say to your young players? Sign that kind of a deal.
I think the number one thing I try to talk to them, and I don't really get that much of an opportunity to, and the opportunity I do get, I really don't want to be the old guy who lost it all, who comes in. You lose that point quickly if you're talking to five guys who are making $13 million a year, because I was there before and I saw the old guy come in. So I just try to tell the guys to stay grounded spiritually, to respect their craft. There's things that they're going to see making that kind of money, and like you alluded to, the money's much more now. Like $100 million now is not as what it was when I played, and that's just 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I just try to tell the guys to be grounded in their craft, grounded spiritually, keep their family members close to them, and just try to stay in that place of being competitive. My voice, though, my one voice, and what I'm going to try to do with this book and speaking with more schools and more professional teams is to try to have it happen every single day. Like, it's got to be repetitive. You've got to have this conversation more than once, because me going against 364 days, 365 days of the year, you really don't – it's really hard to convince young men who are making that kind of money to stay in this lane, because the first thing when you walk through the door is they say, well, that's not going to be me.
Yeah.
Because that's what I said in 1993 when that player came in that had lost it all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I make more money than you. That's not going to be me. Mm-hmm. And so I try to be realistic and not be the guy that's not going to be me guy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be you, but here are the steps that you probably should take off the court, financially, with your advisors, and certainly with your personal life.
And I would assume that one of those steps, if you could get their attention, if you could get past that point of that's not going to be me, this is the old guy showing up, is, you know, it's kind of like what you said before, that you and I, with the money that we make right now, we don't, not only do we not go Lamborghini shopping, but we don't turn our finances really over to anybody else in a way that takes them completely out of our sight, right? Like, I know how much money I make. I know where my money's going. I make public radio money, you know?
Right.
So, and that would make sense for an NBA player, too. I mean, that notion that you rise to a certain level and then you turn it over to somebody else, that actually, I have less to lose than somebody making $100 million.
No, you're exactly right. You know, and you make broadcasts. Now, my checks are less than yours, so I know exactly where my Starbucks money goes every single week. And so it is about that. It's about making it and being responsible for what you do with it, and just having your checkbook in your hand. And it's different. You make money different. One day you're 19 and you're going and asking for $100 to get takeout. And then within months, you have an $80 million deal. So there's a gap there. I think the NBA can do more as far as helping these young men adjust to the lifestyle. But it's a lot to take in. And I hope I can play a small part from my story. And I hope I can play a small part in helping these guys realize who they are once they, you know, you look at the LeBron James of the world and Kevin Durant. These guys are not only players, but they've turned into corporations. And I hope from their part and me doing my small part, we can educate these young men to continue to be great basketball players, but be great businessmen as well.
We're talking to Vin Baker. We're going to give him a chance to take a break, grab a sip of water. We have one more segment coming up here, so stay with us.
Vin Baker was lucky to retire from the NBA when he did. Now you have to write a poem. Today's show was produced by Katie Tilarski and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and our interns are Dan Schultz and Sarah Flaherty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Hawthorne Wingo. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff dunking on the On Point staff, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. And now, back to Colin.
We're back with Vin Baker, NBA, four-time NBA All-Star, Olympic gold medal winner. We've been talking about basketball. We've been talking about Christianity. We haven't talked too much about coffee, but I want to talk about coffee now. You're working at Starbucks, but my understanding is that one reason you're working at Starbucks is that Howard Schultz himself has taken an interest in you.
Yeah, I have a really good relationship with Howard. Once I got out of rehab 4.5 years ago, probably 9 months to my sobriety, I reached out to Howard, and I had a Howard. The history of that is Howard owned the Sonics. I bought the Sonics my second year into my contract, and my second or third year in Seattle, he bought the team, and I actually developed a great relationship with him, like a very personal and private relationship with him. And when I was traded to Boston, you know, that was a tough time because I did have a really good relationship with him and his family, Mrs. Schultz, Sherry Schultz, and Jordan and Natty. And so I reached out to him maybe 9 months into my sobriety and said, I need to work. The sobriety is amazing, and I'm in a great place spiritually. And it was interesting because on the phone that particular day when I spoke to him, the very first thing that he said, "You sound great." Like, he had a connection to me right away, and you know, we met probably about 3 or 4 months later in New York, and he had ideas for me and what I should do. One of them was to go to work with Dr. Butts at Abyssinian in New York, so I did that. After I spent time there in New York with Dr. Butts and Abyssinian, I reached out and said, you know, talked about the next level of it, and the conversation came up, what about retail? And of course, I was just happy to, I mean, if you're talking to Howard himself and to the people that are with Starbucks, it was just a great opportunity. I did not know when I committed to this how hard the job was going to be. I didn't know that everyone customizes drinks and that working at Starbucks wasn't the easiest job. But it's been great. I have the intestinal fortitude and the courage. I'm up for the challenge, but it's just been a great opportunity for me. It balances me as far as going to work every day. I'm co-managing in Eastlime right now with another manager there, and I'm learning so much about business, things that I wouldn't have learned. I talked to Charles Smith, the former Knick, last week, and we were talking about it, and he said, "I don't really think you understand. You were getting a business degree and you're being paid for it. And this is amazing." And so it was an encouragement that I kind of needed at the time. I've been there since June and I thoroughly enjoy it. I enjoy working with the people there at Starbucks, and I enjoy learning the company and the business. It's a tremendous opportunity that I've been given, and one that I don't want to squander. I want to continue to get better at it and continue to learn the business. I'm probably at 15 drinks out of 90 right now, so I've got some more to work on.
What's your position on the red cups? The red cups okay for?
I don't have a position.
Comes
on
down
that.
From corporate.
I haven't worked long enough to make
it's
any
above
decision.
Your pay grade.
That's exactly what I've told a couple customers. That's above my pay grade.
And we're running out of time here. A few things I wanted to ask you about. Now, about a year ago, maybe a little bit more than a year ago, you made the trip to North Korea, right?
I did make that trip with Dennis and with Charles, and it was, in hindsight, which is 2020 for all of us, I wouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
I didn't realize the impact, the negative impact that it would have on us, and certainly we didn't have any idea what we were doing. It was spoken to us about basketball diplomacy, and obviously it didn't come out that way, but it was another lesson learned. I wish Dennis and all those guys the best. It was a lesson learned for me, but fortunately I was able to come back and get back on track.
How does it feel playing at your age? And I mean, I don't know. My knees hurt a lot. I mean, can you get out on the court and feel okay?
I can play. I don't have any real ailments as far as my body's concerned. I think the biggest thing for me is one of the reasons I really don't play. It's the worst. It's almost like a curse that be good at one point and then absolutely be average at another point in your life. It's the worst feeling in the world to go out and see exactly what you want to do, but not be able to execute it. So, and everyone talk trash to you because now they're beating the old Vin Baker.
So I want to ask you, I think this is sort of a thing you don't get to talk about this much and that much. And with the book, it's probably not going to be as big a part of the book as it could be. But you must have some amazingly happy, wonderful, terrific memories about being an NBA player. Was like, are there one or two moments on the court where, I don't know, either you dunked on somebody or do you have like sort of favorite moments you look back and go, that was great. I so enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think playing for Seattle was amazing. We were 61-21 and playing with George Karl and winning for the very first time, like winning significantly for the very first time in my life. I think having a relationship, having a contract with a brand Jordan, having a relationship with Michael, which is really not that documented, but I was kind of one of the first guys to wear my own signature Jordan shoe, and having that relationship with Michael and him having the respect and love for my game that he did at that time of my career will always be special to me. Like anytime my kids will ask and be able to Google about anything, the one thing that sticks out in their mind is like, Dad, you had your own sneaker from Michael Jordan. So I think those times and having those relationships with those players, again, it's just like an education and a degree. There's certain things you just can't take away. And those moments in my career, beating the Bulls one night in Key Arena after I had dinner with Michael and Scotty the night before, and they talked so much trash to me about being in Seattle, how I would never win anything. And then the very next night we played them and beating them with a game winner. It's just – and playing in the Olympics with Gary Payton and Garnett and Duncan, Ray Allen, all the guys. I think I miss those times. Again, they built a lot of character, and the only thing I miss about the NBA is the competition. But I get that in 2K now. I can play my son in 2K, so I'm okay with that.
You know, you mentioned the beating the Bulls, and did you hit the game winner in that?
I did.
Yeah,
I hit a baseline jump shot right in front of the bench, and it was a special night. I probably played that portion of the video over at least 1,000 times. At least.
It's like that Troy Aikman commercial. You know,
yes,
the one where like I'm living in the past. It turns out to be his ringtone.
Exactly. That's exactly. My kids laugh at me because they always look at me like, Dad, you showed this to us at least 100 times.
What feels better, scoring or blocking somebody else's shot? Blocking, say, a Jordan shot or something.
Scoring,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Hitting a game winner or just having someone or being in the zone where no one can stop you, it's one of the feelings you just can't replace.
Can you enjoy basketball now just watching it? Do you watch NBA games?
I do. I always talk to people about watching the game. There's different nuances and different things I see in the game, the personality of the game. It's just not the fun part about playing in the pros is that you can see beyond the score. You can see the personality of the game. You can see the personality of teams beyond their stars, beyond what you see
what kind of people push at you, what they want you to see. Like LeBron's great and Kevin Durant's great. But for me, having played the game, I can kind of see when LeBron hasn't won a championship and know what went into that and what goes into Oklahoma City not being as good as their two great players. So I think that's a fun part of being able to watch the game and enjoy it.
Yeah. Some people are saying now that the Golden State Warriors might be as good a team as has taken the court, as good as those classic Bulls teams.
Well, I'm not one of those bitter old school players to say the game isn't as what it was before. I'm just not like that. I think there's talent. Obviously, LeBron James and Kevin Durant and Steph Curry could have played in any era of basketball. I do, however, believe that the teams of old, the Chicago Bulls, even the Lakers, the Magic Johnson Lakers, the Larry Bird, I think any historian of basketball who really is an aficionado of the game would be find it hard-pressed to think that the Warriors of today could beat the Lakers and the Bulls and the Celtics in a seven-game series. It's my opinion, mm-hmm. and we're all entitled to them. I think those teams were special in their own right, historically special. I think the Golden State Warriors will have a chance to be historically special. But for the eye test, for me, I think I'd go with Magic, mm-hmm. Michael, and Larry.
So 10 years from now, you could be the pastor of a church. You could be an executive with Starbucks. You could be working somewhere in the NBA, either as a coach or for the league or something like that. Which of those alternatives appeals to you the most?
I think, or
a fourth one that I didn't name.
You know, I think being a pastor, I think the influence there would be more relevant. I'd have a chance to really change lives. I think there's a portion of basketball and a portion of being an executive at Starbucks that kind of stops after the job stops. But mm-hmm. I think as being a pastor of a church, that you can have an everlasting, eternal place on somebody's life. And that's what I'm shooting for. That's what keeps me going, is having that eternal and everlasting place in somebody's mind or some kind of influence in their life. And I think from being a pastor, but I'm going to try for all three.
So you'd be okay. You'd be comfortable with the idea of maybe going back to the NBA as a coach, as a front office guy, as something.
Absolutely. Well, this past year, I've been able to work. I've been fortunate and blessed enough to work with the Bucks. I've worked with the Knicks. I do alumni work with them. And I also, you know, again, I'm currently store managing with Starbucks, and I just preached this past Sunday at my father's church. So I'm handling it now from this level. I don't know what that would entail 10 years from now, but I feel comfortable handling it. I think they all kind of serve the same purpose, is helping people at the end of the day.
And it could be argued, too, that as big an impact as a pastor can have, and that's big, is that somebody who takes those values and exhibits them in a different context, you know, that having all of the beliefs, having the faith that you have and the way that the faith gets lived out in your life, doing that while working for Starbucks, doing that while working for the Milwaukee Bucks or mm-hmm. whatever, you're injecting yourself into that environment
right.
in a way that it's not expected. In some ways, that can almost be a bigger thing.
Absolutely. It's certainly when I preach on Sundays or teach on Wednesday nights at my father's church, it certainly helps that I can share 5 to 6 caramel macchiato stories with my congregation. It just all fits. It's a place of humility. It's a place of faith. It's a place of belief. And I think people identify. I think people identify from where I'm coming from, as far as talking about the church and talking about I'm working and I was in Milwaukee and I was working with these kids. And when you combine it all, it all helps the ministry.
I think that's in Matthew 11, is the parable of the caramel macchiato. All right. We have to stop, Vin Baker, but it's been great visiting with you, and it's a great story. We look forward to the book when that's done. Thanks for coming up here today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.